Johnny was sure it would become taboo to walk within that circle. It was only a few steps further to avoid it altogether. Dawn was there. They had to work fast to be out of there before midday, and there might be other spots. The recon drone passed near here and lately was overflying around noon. He wanted no pictures of this operation on Turl's screens. A circle of rope was nothing. It would look like a stock corral. Tracks were nothing. People and horses and dogs wandered around. But the plane up the canyon and three differently garbed people were something else. While they chewed some breakfast Aunt Ellen brought them, Johnny looked out across the expansive meadow. What a lot of ground to cover. He made up his mind. It was a risk, but very brief exposures, according to toxicology texts, could be tolerated. He got an air mask and bottles out of the gear Angus had brought. He filled his pockets with breathe gas flasks. He got a bucket of ashes. He got on one of their horses. "I am going to crisscross this meadow at a dead run," he told Angus and the parson. "Back and forth and back and forth on paths 30 feet apart. I'll be holding a breathe gas vial in my hand, turned slightly on. Every time it flashes, I'll throw down a handful of ashes and then hold up my arm. Now, parson, I want you to stand on that knoll and make a sketch of this valley, and you, Angus, tell him each time I hold up my hand. Got it?" They got it. The parson went up to the knoll with a pad and pen, and Angus following him. The three young men who had voted to move wanted to know whether they could help. Johnny told them yes, they could have fresh horses ready. Johnny looked around. All was ready. The red gold sun made the snow glisten. He made sure his air mask was tight, opened the breathe gas vial, and put a heel to the horse. Only a minute later, the vial in his hand flashed. He threw down ashes, raised his arm, and sped on at a dead run. Angus's yell floated to him on the still air. The parson was marking it on his sketch. Back and forth across the meadow. A flash, a handful of ashes, a raised hand, the echo of Angus's yell, and the thud of the flying hoofs. He took a new horse, opened a new bottle, and was off again. Villagers gazed dully on the scene. Johnny Goodboy had often done strange things. Yes, he was quite a horseman. Everybody knew that. It was a bit of a mystery why he kept lighting a torch every now and then, but old Jimson had some explanation from the clergyman who had come with Johnny, a real clergyman from some village named Scotland. They hadn't known there was any nearby village. Oh, yes, there had been. It was a long time ago. It was a couple of ridges over. Well, in all this snow, one didn't get a chance to get about much. But Johnny Goodboy sure could ride, couldn't he? Look at the snow fly. 2 hours, 4 lathered horses, 16 vials of breathe gas, and a tired Johnny later, they got ready to take their leave. They were a bit pressed for time, too pressed to evaluate the map. They had decided to leave the horses as a gift and would have to walk to the plane. The parson was explaining to Jimson that people must stay well away from those ash marks, and Jimson respectfully said he would see to it even if Brown Limper was skeptical. Aunt Ellen was looking frightened.
"You're leaving again, Johnny?"
She was trying to work out how to tell him that he was the only family she had. "Would you like to come with me?" said Johnny. "Well, no. This was their home, Johnny. He should come back. Going to wild places was in his blood," she guessed. He promised to try to come back and then gave her some gifts he had saved until last. A great big stainless steel kettle and 3 knives and a fur robe with sleeves in it. She pretended to like that very much, but she was crying when he turned back at the edge of the upper path and waved. She had a horrible feeling she would never see him again. 6. It was an intense hum of intent men in the room of the old mining town near the lode. Several groups were hard at work. It had amused the Scots very much to take over the offices of the Empire Dauntless Mining Corporation. The building had been almost intact, and, when cleaned up, made an acceptable operations room. Johnny half suspected that somebody had rebuilt the town after the lead load mine had played out. It was too unlike other towns. He tried to figure out why anyone would reconstruct a town after its ore was gone, but evidence certainly showed someone had. Next door was a place called the Bucket of Blood Saloon that the parson had gravely put off limits. It still had its glasses and mirrors intact, and paintings of nearly nude dancing girls and cupids could dimly be made out. Across the street was an office labeled Wells Fargo, and another one labeled Jail. They all lived in the London Palace Elite Hotel, which had labeled suites named after men who must have been famous in mining. Three of the old widows queened it over the coal-burning galley Angus had explained to them. It had running water. Luxury. The Empire Dauntless offices contained what must have been working models of the mine, and they had found history pamphlets in it that talked about the good old wild days of a boom camp and bad men. Also, curious little leaflets that said tour schedules and had a daily time and place scheduled for a bank holdup. Paintings of prospectors and mine discoverers and bad men had been cleaned off and put back on the walls. Robert the Fox and two pilots were studiously going over possible plans to hijack an ore freighter. They had no craft that could possibly fly to Scotland or Europe, for their mine equipment could only go a few hundred miles. They had been going around and around this problem ever since the night the demon had told them about bomber drones. They felt they had a responsibility to alert not only the Scots, but other peoples they might find traces of. They dared not alert the cyclos they were up to anything. To intercept in the air, leaving the cyclos to believe the freighter had gone down over the sea, was the only thing they kept coming up with. But to silence the cyclo pilot radio, to board a freighter plane to plane in mid-air, were some of the things they couldn't work out. Another group, two of the leaders who were off shift, with Thor and Dunaldine and some of the miners, were going over mining progress. They had gotten down to the load and were drifting along it inch by inch toward the cliff. The quartz they were taking out was pure and beautiful, but it had no gold in it. Johnny had explained to them, from references, that it was a load with pockets. Wire gold veins only had pockets of gold every few hundred feet. It was not continuous valuable ore. They were getting tired of mining pure white quartz with no gold to show for it. They were trying to figure out how close they were to the fissure in the cliff. It had widened a tiny amount, which worried them. The historian, Dr. McDermott, was off by himself, chair tilted against a wall, reading industriously from things his scout had lately brought in from a collapsed school library in a little mining town. Johnny, Angus, the parson, and the schoolmaster were clustered over the parson's sketch of the valley. The positions of the live radiation points were in a line. At first, Johnny had thought it might be a vein of uranite popping to the surface at intervals, but the points were too regular. "They are roughly 100 feet apart," said Johnny, "in a straight line." They were staring at the map, thinking, when Dr. McDermott came over.
"It's something funny I've got here, McTyler," said the historian, shaking his book. "The Chinko guidebook was mistaken about the Air Force Academy."
Johnny shrugged. They often said things just to please the cyclos.
"But they called the Academy a primary defense base."
"I know," said Johnny. "They wanted it to sound big because it was the last battle fought on the planet."
"But there was a primary defense base," said the historian, shaking the book he held.
Johnny looked at it. It was Regulations Regarding and Governing the Evacuation of School Children in the Event of Atomic War, Department of Civil Defense.
"Apparently," said the historian, "the children were to be kept in school until the town mayor was flown out to the city. Here it is. and that all orders thereafter shall be issued from the primary defense base.
But we don't know where that was, said Johnny. The old man scuttled back to his pile of books.
Yes, we do.
He came back with a volume concerning congressional hearings into cost overruns of military budgets. McDermott opened the volume to where he had marked it. He read,
Question by Senator Aldrich. The Secretary of Defense then freely admits that the overrun of $1.6 billion in the construction of the primary defense base in the Rocky Mountains was incurred without congressional authority. Is that correct, Mr. Secretary?
McDermott showed Johnny and slapped the book shut.
So the Chinkos were wrong while they were being right. There was a primary defense base, and it was in the Rocky Mountains.
He smiled primly and started back to his chair. Johnny went very still. The tomb. The iron doors. The dead troops on the stairs. The tomb. Dr. Mack, Johnny called. Come back here. He showed him the sketch. You told us a story once about a line of nuclear mines laid by the Queen's own Highlanders from Dumbarton to Falkirk. The historian nodded. He was looking at the sketch.
Did you find some wrecked remains of cyclotanks?
He said. No, said Johnny. But look, this line goes exactly across the exit from the pass from the lower plains. They're exactly spaced. They're in an exact straight line.
But with no tanks, said the parson.
They never exploded, said Johnny. Time just made them fall apart.
How did you guess this? Said the historian.
Johnny smiled. It was a little bit hard to speak. He indicated the sketch to cover his surge of emotion. After a moment, he said, That pass leads up from the western plain to the meadow. And behind that meadow, there's a canyon that goes up into the mountains. And way up that canyon is the primary defense base of the ancient government of man. He filled in the rest of the sketch. Other groups had sensed something was happening. They began drifting over. Johnny felt like crying. He swallowed hard. I wondered where they sent all the uranium they'd mined. I knew it must be somewhere. The parson touched his arm, not wanting him to run into a future failure with a crash.
They would not have had it in the base, laddie.
But the base records will tell us where it is, said Johnny. It would have maps, wires of communication. I know we'll crack this there. Angus had been staring at the sketch.
Ooh, he was saying to himself. Landmines, and I was just going to burrow in.
Robert the Fox was already gathering up those in charge to begin their expedition to the tomb. The historian was diving for references that would tell them the perils of entering tombs.
Don't fret, laddie,
said the parson to Johnny, who was just sitting there staring.
Dawning will tell us if it's true.
Chapter 10 1 The doors were cracked open just as he had left them so many years ago. Lying there, crusted with snow, but just where he had dropped it, was the iron bar he had used to open the doors. The smell might or might not be there, for he was now wearing an air mask. They had left just as soon as they could see to fly, and Johnny had spotted them down accurately just before the door. Behind him in the canyon, the Scots were unloading gear. The plane would have to leave, and they would have to obliterate all tracks with snow before the recon drone came over on its daily round. The calm voice of Robert the Fox was directing them.
Have you got the lamps? Check out the spare air bottles. Where is Daniel? Easy with those explosives.
A Scot came up with a sledgehammer to open the door wider, and Angus rushed over and pushed him aside.
No, no, no. 'Tis just wanting a bit of penetrating oil.
Angus was popping the bottom of an oil can. His voice sounded muffled through the air mask. They were all getting air masks on. The historian had found it was very unhealthy to enter tombs. Something called spores sometimes came off bone dust of the long dead and made a man cough his lungs out.
"Mind if I slip in first, Johnny?" said Angus.
Johnny took his shoulder pack so Angus could slide through. The mine lamp played on the interior.
"Ugh, enough dead men."
His oil can was popping on hinges.
"Try it, Johnny."
Johnny put his shoulder to the doors and they swung back, shooting a blast of light down the stairs. Angus had stepped out of the way and was now waiting on littered corpses, puffs of bone dust rising around his boots. They all stood for a moment, looking down the steps, awed. On this graveyard of a planet, they were no strangers to dead remains. They lay in structures and basements in abundance, wherever there was any protection from wild animals or the weather, corpses more than 1,000 years dead. But reaching down this long flight of stairs were the remains of several hundred men. Protected from the air until 12 years ago, their clothing, arms, and equipment were somewhat preserved, but the bones had gone to powder.
"They fell forward," said Robert the Fox. "Must have been a regiment marching in. See? These two fellows at the top of the steps must have been closing the doors."
"The gas," said Johnny. "They opened the doors to let the regiment in, looks like, and the gas hit them from the canyon."
"Wipe the place out," said Robert the Fox. "Listen, all of you. Don't go in there without a tight air mask."
"We ought to bury these men," said the parson. "They each have little tags on them."
He picked one up.
"Nolans, Peter, Private, USMC, number 35473524, blood type B.
"Marines," said the historian.
"We've got a military base here, all right."
"Do you suppose," said the parson to Johnny, "that village of yours could once have been a marine base? It is different than other towns."
"The village has been rebuilt 12 times, said Johnny. "Robert, let's go in."
"Remember your priorities," said Robert to the group. "Inventory only. Don't touch records until they're identified. This is a big place. Don't stray or get lost."
"We ought to bury these bodies," said the parson.
We will," said Robert. "All in good time. Gunners, forward. Flush out and destroy any animals."
5 Scots carrying submachine guns raced down the steps, alert for bears or snakes in hibernation, or stray wolves.
"Ventilation team, stand by," said Robert, and glanced over his shoulder to make sure the 3 assigned to carry the heavy mine ventilation fans were there and ready.
There was an uneven burst of fire below. The sub-Thompson ammunition was dud 2 rounds out of 5, and to get a sustained burst, one had to recock the bolt in mid-fire. Robert's small, limited-range radio crackled,
"Rattlesnakes, 4, all dead, end comm."
"Aye,"
said Robert the Fox into the mic. There was another ragged burst of fire. The radio crackled.
"Brown bear, hibernating, dead, end come."
"Aye," said Robert.
"Second set of doors, tight locked."
"Explosives team," Robert called over his shoulder.
"Nah, nah," said Angus. "We may need those doors."
"Go ahead," said Robert. "Belay explosives team, but stand by."
Into the mic.
"Mechanic en route."
They waited. The radio crackled.
"Doors open."
A pause.
"Area beyond seems airtight. Probably no hostile animals beyond. End comm."
"Ventilation team, forward," said Robert.
The last man on that team was carrying a cage of rats. Presently, a current of air began to come out of the tomb. The radio crackled.
"Rats still alive. End comm."
"There you are, McTyler," said Robert.
Johnny checked his face mask and walked down through the dust of the stairs. He heard Robert firing the rest of the teams behind him, and then giving orders to clean up the outside area and dust all traces with snow when the planes left. The orders sounded way off and thin in the booming caverns of the primary defense base of a long-dead nation. 2. Johnny's miner's lamp played upon the floors and walls of what seemed like endless corridors and rooms. The place was huge. Offices, 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 barracks, storerooms. Their footsteps resounded hollowly, disturbing the millennia-long sleep of the dead. The first find was a stack of duplicated routing plans for the base. A Scot found them in a reception desk drawer. They were not very detailed, apparently intended to route visiting officers around. The Scot got permission to distribute, and, racing up, miner's lamp bobbing, shoved a copy into Johnny's hand. Level after level existed. There was not just a maze at one level, but also mazes down, down, and down. He was looking for an operations office, some place where dispatches might mount up, where information was collected. Operations, operations, where would that be? Behind him, an argument broke out. It was Angus and Robert the Fox at the other end of the corridor. Angus's voice was raised.
I knew it's all by elevators.
There was a murmur from Robert.
I knew it's all electrical. I've been through all this before at the first school. Electrical, 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 it takes generators. And they're just piles of congealed rust. Even if you got one to run, there's no fuel. It's just sludge in the tanks. And even if you put in juice, those light bulbs won't work, and the electric motors are frozen solid.
Robert murmured something.
Sure, the wires may be all right, but even if you got juice in them, all you'd have is an intercom, and we've got that. So stick to miner's lamps. I'm sorry, Sir Robert, but there's just so much dinosaur you can revive from a pile of bones.
Johnny heard Robert laughing. He himself differed a little bit with Angus's point of view. They did not know that there weren't emergency systems that might work some other way. And they did not know that there might not be other fuels in sealed containers that might still function. The chances were thin, but they could not be ruled out. They were despairingly going to rig mine cables to get to the other levels when a Scot found ramps and stairwells going down. Operations. Operations. They found a communications console, the communicator's remains at the desk. Under the dust that had been his hand was a message. Urgent. Don't fire. It isn't the Russians.
Russians? Russians? Said a Scot. Who were the Russians?
Thor had come, absent without leave, from his shift at the load, but intending to get back. He was part Swedish.
There's some people that used to live on the other side of Sweden. They were run by the Swedes once.
Don't disturb any messages, said Robert the Fox.
Operations. Operations. They found themselves in an enormous room. It had a huge map of the world on a middle table. Apparently, clerks with long poles pushed little models around on the map. There were side wall maps and a balcony overlooking it. Miners' lamps flicked over maps, models, and the remains of the dead. Impressive and well-preserved. There were lots of clocks, all stopped long ago. A huge, hastily made cylinder model rested on the map just east of the Rockies. A long pole was still touching it, the last action of a dead arm. Another map on the wall was plotting the course of something, and the last X was straight above this base. It was too much data to sort out in a moment. Johnny went on looking. They found themselves in a nearby room. It had lots of consoles. Top Secret had been the name of this room. One console said Local Defense and had a chart and map over it. Johnny went to it and looked closely. TNW Minefields, he read. Then suddenly he found himself looking at marks of the string mines in the meadow below them. TNW 15. There was a firing button. TNW 15. But there were rows and rows of these buttons. TNW. TNW. The reedy voice of the historian piped up behind him.
TNW means tactical nuclear weapons. Those are the mines.
Angus came over.
Ugh, electrical firing buttons. You push the console button and up they go.
Might also be fused for contact, said Johnny cautiously. No wonder the cyclos thought these mountains were radioactive.
What's a silo?
Said the parson at another board.
It says silo 1, silo 2, and so on.
A silo, said Thor, is where you keep wheat. They used to have them in Sweden. You put wheat in them for storage.
I can't imagine why they'd be that interested in wheat. Look at the way these buttons are marked. Standby, ready, fire.
The historian was hastily rifling through a dictionary he habitually carried. He found it.
1. A cylindrical upright storage facility for wheat, grain, and other foodstuffs. 2. A large underground structure for the storage and launching of a long-range ballistic missile.
Johnny reached out and grabbed the parson's wrist. Don't touch that console. It could contain emergency systems about which we know nothing. He turned, excited. Robert, get this whole board and layout picto-recorded. We have to know the exact location of every silo on that board. Those missiles might have uranium in them. 3. They were in a storeroom area now. Angus had found a huge ring of keys and was scampering ahead of Johnny, opening doors. Robert the Fox was following more sedately. He had his worn old cape wrapped very tightly about him, for it was bitterly cold in this place. Probably the temperature seldom rose much, even in summer. Robert's radio crackled occasionally as some Scot elsewhere reported in. The radios worked well underground, designed for minor use. Johnny had not yet found all he wanted by a long shot. The planning of a battle against an enemy whose battle tactics were all but unknown was a chancy business, and he did not yet know exactly how the cyclos had done it. So he had half an ear to Robert's radio and was not paying all that much attention to Angus. They were at a heavy door that said Arsenal, and Angus was changing keys about to open it. Some faint hope that it might contain nuclear weapons rose in Johnny. The door opened. Boxes, cases, endless rows of them. Johnny played his lamp over the stencils. He did not know what all these letters meant. This military certainly loved to obscure things under letters and numbers. Angus danced up with a book, fluttering the well-preserved pages.
Ordnance types and models, he crooned. All the numbers and letters will be here, even pictures.
Inventory that, said Robert the Fox to a Scot beside him who was making lists.
Bazooka, said Angus. There, up there, those long boxes. Anti-tank armor-piercing missile projectiles.
Nuclear? Asked Johnny.
Non-nuclear, says Sue.
I think, said Robert, this is just their local arsenal for possible base use. They wouldn't be supplying the whole army from this spot.
Lots of it, said Angus.
Enough for a few thousand men, said Robert.
Can I open a box?
Asked Angus to Robert.
One or two for now, just to ascertain condition, said Robert, and waved a couple of the following Scots forward to assist.
Angus was flipping through the catalogue, miner's lamp dancing on the pages.
Ah, here! Thompson's submachine gun!
He stopped and looked up at the boxes. He shook his head and looked back at the page.
No wonder.
No wonder what?
Prompted Robert, a bit impatient. The recon drone must have passed overhead by this time, and they had had no lunch and needed a break to recharge their air bottles outside.
That ammunition we found was very well preserved. Airtight? Well, it maybe had to be. This sub-Thompson was a century out of date when we found the truckload. They must have just been sending them to the cadets to practice with. They were relics.
Johnny was not about to try to fight cyclos with sub-Thompsons. He started to pass on. Boxes were being opened behind him. Angus raced up. His lamp was shining on an all-metal, lightweight hand rifle. It was block-solid, covered with grease that ages ago had formed into a tight, hard cast.
Mark 50 assault rifle, said Angus. The last thing they issued. I can clean these up so they purr.
Johnny nodded. It was a sleek weapon. Magazine, said the door ahead of him. It was a doubly thick door. Meant ammunition. Maybe tactical nuclear weapons? Angus let another Scot open it for him. He was back there rummaging in cases. A box right ahead, standing among vast tiers of boxes, said, Ammunition, Mark 50 Assault. Johnny took a jimmy out of his belt and pried open the top. It was not airtight. The cardboard dividers were decayed and stained. The brass was okay and the bullet clean, but the primer at the bottom told its tale. The ammunition was dud. He called Angus and showed him the cartridge. They went on looking for nuclear weapons. More storerooms and more storerooms. And then, pay dirt. Johnny found himself looking at literally thousands of outfits, neatly arranged on shelves, even with sizes, complete with shoes and face-plated helmets, packed in a kind of plastic that was airtight and nearly imperishable. Combat radiation protection uniforms. His excited hands ripped open a package. Lead-impregnated clothing. Lead glass faceplates. And in mountain camouflage, gray, tan, and green. Riches. The one thing that would let them handle radiation. He showed Robert the fox. Robert put it on the radio as real news, but told the others to go on with their own searches and inventories. They were on their way outside for food and air when another piece of news came through. It was Dunnell Dean. Apparently he had relieved Thor, who had to go on shift at the mine. Dunnell Dean wasn't even supposed to be there.
We got some great big huge security safes here,
Dunnell Dean's voice came over the radio.
No combination. One is marked top secret nuclear and classified personnel only. Manuals. We need an explosives team. Endcom.
He guided them to him. Robert the Fox looked at Angus, and Angus shook his head.
No keys, said Angus.
The explosives team rigged non-flame blasting cartridges to the hinges, and everyone went into the next corridor while the explosives team trailed wire. They held their ears. The concussion was head-splitting. A moment later, they heard the crash of a door hitting the floor. The fire member of the team raced in with an extinguisher, but it was not needed. Lamps beamed through the settling dust. Presently they were holding in their hands operations manuals, maintenance manuals, repair manuals, hundreds and hundreds of separate manuals that gave every particular of every nuclear device that had been built, how to set it, fire it, fuse and defuse it, store it, handle it, and safeguard it.
Now we've got everything but the nuclear devices, said Robert the Fox.
Yes, said Johnny. You can't shoot with papers. 4. It must have been night outside, but nothing could be darker than the deep guts of this ancient defense base. The black seemed to press in upon them as though possessed of actual weight. The miners' lamps were darting shafts through ink. They had come down a ramp, gone through an air-sealed door, and found an enormous cavern. The sign said Heliport. The time-decayed bulks of collapsed metal that stood along the walls had been some kind of planes, planes with large fans on top. Johnny had seen pictures of them in the man books. They were called helicopters. He stared at the single one sitting in the middle of the vast floor. The small party of Scots with him were interested in something else. The doors. They were huge, made of metal, reaching far right and far left and up beyond their sight. Another entrance to the base, a fly-in entrance for their type of craft. Angus was scrambling around some motors to the side of the doors.
Electrical? Electrical? I wonder if these poor lads ever thought there would be a day when you had to do something manually. What if the power failed?
It's failed, said Robert the Fox,
his low voice booming in the vast hangar.
"Call me the lamp, boys," said Angus,
and presently the two Scots, who were packing lamps, batteries, wires, and fuses for their own lighting, trotted down the ramp, pushing their gear ahead of them on a dolly they had found. Hammering began over by the motors that operated the doors. Robert the Fox came over to Johnny.
"If we can get those doors to open and close, we can fly in and out of here. There's a sighting port over there, and it shows the outside looks like a cave opening, overhung, not visible to the drone."
Johnny nodded, but he was looking at the center helicopter. The air was different here. He could feel it on his hands. Drier. He went over to the helicopter. Yes, there was his eagle, with arrows in its claws, dim but huge on the side of this machine. Not like the other machines, which had minor insignia. He made out the letters, "President of the United States." This was a special plane. The historian answered his pointing finger.
"Head of the country, commander-in-chief of the armed forces."
Johnny was puzzled. Yes, possibly he had gotten here on that day of disaster 1,000 or more years ago. But if so, where was he? There had been no such sign on the offices. He walked around the hangar. Ha! There was another elevator, a smaller one in a different place. He looked further and found a door to a stairwell that led upward. The door was hard to open, apparently air-sealed. He got through it and mounted upward. Behind him, the hammer and clang of the group faded and died. There was only the soft pat of his feet on the stairs. Another air-sealed door at the top, even harder to open. This was an entirely different complex. It stood independent of the rest of the base. And due to dry air and seals and possibly something else, the bodies were not dust. They were mummified. Officers on the floor slumped over desks. Only a few. Communication and file rooms. A briefing room with few chairs. A bar with glasses and bottles intact. Very superior grade of furnishings, carpets, all very well preserved. Then he saw the door symbol he was looking for and went in. The sign was on the splendid polished desk. A huge eagle plaque on the wall. A flag, with some of its fabric still able to stir when he caused a faint breeze opening the door. The man was slumped over the desk, mummified. Even his clothing still looked neat. Johnny stood under the parchment hand, and without touching it, slid out the sheaf of papers. The top date and the hour were 2 days later than the ones that ended in the operations room in the other complex. The only explanation Johnny could think of was that the ventilation systems didn't join. When gas hit the main base, the system was turned off here, and they had not dared turn it back on. The president and his staff had died from lack of air. Johnny felt strangely courteous and respectful as he removed more papers from the desk and trays. He held in his hands the last hours of the world, report by report. Even pictures, and something from high up called satellite pictures. He hastily skimmed through the reports to make sure he had it all. A strange object had appeared over London without any trace of where it came from. Teleportation, filled in Johnny. It had been at an altitude of 30,000 feet. Important, thought Johnny. It had dropped a canister, and within minutes the south of England was dead. Cyclogas. The myths and legends. It had cruised eastward at 302.6 miles per hour. Vital data, thought Johnny. It had been attacked by fighter planes from Norway. It had not fought back. It had been hit with everything they had without the slightest evidence of damage to it. Armor, thought Johnny. An interchange on something called the Hotline prevented a nuclear missile exchange between the United States and Russia. The "Don't fire, it isn't the Russians" message on the desk in the other complex, thought Johnny. It was hit with nuclear weapons over Germany without the slightest apparent damage. No pilots, thought Johnny. It was a drone. No breathe gas in it. Very heavy motors. It had then toured the major population centers of the world, dropping canisters and wiping out populations. And wiped out the other complex of this base without even knowing or caring that it was there, thought Johnny. On the operations map of the other complex, they had plotted it only just to the east of this location. It then went on to obliterate the eastern part of the United States. The reports had come in from dew-line stations in the Arctic and some parts of Canada. It continued on its almost leisurely way to wipe out all population centers in the southern hemisphere. But at this point, something else began to happen. Isolated observers and satellites reported tanks of a strange design materializing one after the other in various parts of the world, and mopping up fleeing hordes of human beings. Stage 2, teleportation, thought Johnny. Military reports, out of sequence and incomplete, were shuffled in with the reports of the tanks. All major military airfield installations, whether gassed out of existence or not, were being blown to bits by strange, very fast-flying craft. Battle planes teleported in at the same time as the tanks. Reports of some tanks exploding, some battle planes exploding. Reasons not known. Manned craft, thought Johnny. Breathe gas hitting areas of radiation caused by firing on the drone with nuclear weapons. The drone spotted by satellite landing near Colorado City, Colorado. Causes most structures there to collapse. Preset remote control, thought Johnny. Even their central command mine site had been picked out. Whole area carefully plotted and observed by casting picto recorders. Rough, uncontrolled landing of drone near pre-planned command area. Tank spotted by satellite shooting at pocket of cadets wearing flight oxygen masks at the Air Force Academy. Report by acting commander of Corps of Cadets. Then no further communication. The last battle, thought Johnny. Efforts from the comm room to contact somebody, anybody, anywhere, via a remote antenna located 300 miles to the north. Antenna location bombed by enemy battle plane. Radio tracking, thought Johnny. Unspotted, but with their air shut off, the president and his aides and staff had lasted 2 more hours until they died of asphyxiation. Johnny put the papers respectfully in a protecting mine bag. Feeling a bit strange for speaking, he said to the corpse, "I'm sorry no help came. We are something over 1,000 years late." He felt very bad. His gloom would have followed him as he left the dreary, dark, cold quarters, had not the barking, cheery voice of Dunnell Dean sprung from the radio at his belt. Johnny halted and acknowledged.
"Johnny, laddie," said Dunnell Dean. "You can stop worrying yourself about scraping uranium out of the dirt. There's a full nuclear arsenal, complete with assorted bombs, intact, just 30 miles north of here. We found the map and a plane just checked it out. Now all we've got to worry about is blowing off our innocent little heads and exploding this whole planet in the bargain."
5. Disaster struck in the form of an earthquake on day 32 of the new year. Shortly after midnight, the tremor awakened Johnny. Equipment on his bureau in the London Palace Elite Hotel rattled together, and he sat up in his bed. The prolonged throb of vibration was still occurring. The old building groaned. The rumble of the earthquake traveled on. It was followed by a second, lesser tremor a half minute later, and then that was gone. It was not too unusual in the Rockies. No damage seemed to be done in the old mining town. Uneasy, but not really alarmed, Johnny pulled on buckskin pants and moccasins and, throwing a puma skin over his shoulders, sprinted through the snow to the Empire Dauntless. The duty sentry's light was on. The young Scot was tapping a buzzer key that activated the communication system to the mine. It was a directional laser radio, limited to an exact width and undetectable beyond these mountains. The Scot looked up. His face was a bit white.
"They don't answer."
He tapped the key again more rapidly, as though his finger by itself could shoot the beam through.
Maybe the receiver pole got twisted in the quake.
In minutes, Johnny had a relief crew routed out, spare ropes and winches assembled, blankets and stimulants packaged and being loaded on the passenger plane. Strained faces turned repeatedly toward the mine, even though it was far out of their line of sight. They were worried for the mine duty shift. Thor, a shift leader named Dwight, and 15 men. The night was black as coal. Even the stars were masked by high, invisible clouds. It was no mean stunt flying these mountains in the dark. The instruments of the mine plane glowed green as the ship vaulted upward. The image screen painted a blurred picture of the terrain ahead. Johnny adjusted it to sharpness. Beside him, a co-pilot made some console plane weight corrections. Johnny was depending on his eyes to avoid the first mountain slope. He flipped on the plane's beam lights. They struck the snow slope, and he eased the plane up over it. He knew that things had been going too well. They had been making real progress in their preparations. They were far from ready, but what they had accomplished had been miraculous. He hunted ahead for the next mountainside, checking the view screen. Good Lord, it was dark. He checked his compass. The men in the back were tense and silent. He could almost feel what they were thinking. The top knoll flipped by under them. A little too close. Where was the next one? The assault rifles he had at first considered worthless were proving the very thing. With a great deal of ingenuity, they had salvaged the ammunition. They had drawn out the bullets from the case and tapped out the primer. By careful experimentation, they had found out how to substitute a blasting cap in the bottom of the shell case. At first, they had thought they would also need powder, and had blown up a rifle trying it. No casualties. It turned out that the blasting cap was enough to fire a bullet at high velocity. Johnny swerved the plane to avoid a suddenly looming cliff and went a little higher. If he went too high, he could lose his way entirely if lights were out at the mine. His lights might also become visible at the compound. Stay low. Dangerous, but stay low. Then they had taken the bullets and drilled a small hole in the nose and, wearing radiation suits, inserted a grain of radioactive material from a TNW. They had covered this with a thin bit of melted lead. In this way, a man could carry the ammunition without danger of radiation hitting him. But when it was fired, oh my! They tried it on breathe gas in a glass bottle, and did that breathe gas explode? Too low, Johnny had recognized a lone scrub on a ridge. He lifted the plane over it. They were on course. Hold down the speed. Don't have another disaster flying in the dark. The bullets were also armor-piercing to some degree, and when fired into a breathe gas vial 200 yards away, caused a violent reaction that brought concussion all the way back to them. They put every available Scott onto an assembly line converting bullets, and they had cases and cases of them now. 100 assault rifles and 500 magazines had been cleaned to perfection. They fired without a stutter or dud. No good against a tank or a thick lead-glass compound dome, but those assault rifles would be deadly to individual cyclos. With breathe gas in their bloodstreams, they would literally explode. He spotted the river that ran out of the gorge. He eased down, following it, the plane's lights flashing on the uneven ice and snow. They'd been so happy about the assault rifles that they had gone to work on the bazookas. They had found some nuclear artillery shells and had converted their noses over to the bazooka noses, and now they had armor-piercing nuclear bazookas. There were still a number of those left to make. Yes, it had been too smooth, too good to be true. There were no lights on the mine pad ahead. There was no one visible there at all. He set the plane down on the pad. The passengers boiled out of it. Their lights darted this way and that. One of them, who had run to the chasm edge, called back, his voice thin in the cold darkness.
"Johnny, the cliff face has gone!"
6. A light shone down from the present edge and confirmed it. The fissure, 30 feet back from the old edge, had simply opened in the earthquake and fallen into the gorge. The cliff face was no longer overhanging, but sloped up toward them. In the light, the wide edge of the broken-off quartz lode was visible. It was pure white, no gold in the remaining vein. The pocket of gold was gone. But Johnny was thinking right now of the crew. They had not reached the fissure, for the avalanche had exposed no tunnel. They were somehow trapped under them, if they were still alive. Johnny raced back to the shaft edge. It yawned blackly, a large circle of emptiness, silent. The shaft was about 100 feet deep. He looked around, flashing his light. The hoist. Where is the hoist? The entire apparatus used to take out ore and lower and raise men was missing. Lights played down the mountain. It was not on the slope. Johnny approached the hole more closely. Then he saw the slide marks of the cross timbers that had supported the hoist cage over the hole. The hoist was down there in the shaft.
"Be very quiet, everyone," said Johnny.
Then he bent over and cupped his hands and shouted down.
"Down there! Is anyone alive?"
They listened.
"I thought I heard something,"
said the parson, who had come along. Johnny tried again. They listened. They could not be sure. Johnny turned on his belt radio and spoke into it. No answer. He saw Angus in the rescue team.
"Angus, drop an intercom on a cable down into that hole."
While Angus and two others were doing that, Johnny pulled a picto recorder out of the rescue gear. He found more cable and extended its leads. Angus had rigged and lowered the intercom. Johnny signaled to the parson. The place was broadly lit now with lamps the relief crew had put on poles. The parson's hand was shaking as he held the intercom mic.
"Hello, the mine," said the parson.
The intercom mic down there should pick up voices if there was any reply. There wasn't.
"Keep trying," said Johnny.
He paid out the line of the picto recorder and lowered it into the hole. Robert the Fox stepped forward from the relief group and took charge of the portable screen. At first, there was just the shaft wall sliding by as the picto recorder went down. Then a piece of timber, then a tangle of cable, then the hoist. Johnny rotated the cable and shifted the remote control to wide angle. The hoist was empty. A sigh of relief joined the night wind as the tense group saw that no one had been killed in the hoist. Johnny worked the remote to look over the hoist. It was hard to tell, but it did not appear there was anybody crushed under the fallen hoist. The picto recorder swung idly on its cable 90 feet below them. Eyes strained at the view screen, begging it for data.
"No drift hole," said Johnny. "The drift hole isn't visible. When the hoist fell in, it caved in the entrance to the drift down there."
Pressing a flying platform into service, they flew a 3-man crew down to the bottom of the drift. Robert the Fox wouldn't let Johnny go down on it. One of the men dropped down from the platform and fixed lifting hooks into the cage cable, and they pulled it back up to the top of the hole. They rigged a crane, pulleys, and a winch, and 33 minutes later, clocked by the historian, who also had sneaked aboard the relief plane, they had the hoist out of the shaft and sitting off to the side. Johnny put the picto recorder back down, and it confirmed his guess. The shaft end of the level drift down there was blocked, knocked shut when the hoist fell. They rigged buckets to crane cable, and very shortly they had 4 men down at the bottom. Johnny ignored Robert and went this time. They tore at the rocks with their hands, filling up buckets that shot aloft to be replaced by empty ones. More tools and welcome sledges came down. 2 hours went by. They changed 3 of the men twice. Johnny stayed down there. They worked in a blur of speed. The rattle of rocks and thud of sledges freeing them resounded in the dusty hole bottom. The rock fall was thicker than they had hoped. 2 feet into the drift, 3 feet, 4 feet, 5 feet. Maybe the whole drift had collapsed. They changed crews. Johnny stayed down there. 3 hours and 16 minutes after the arrival at the bottom, Johnny heard a distant whisper of sound.
He held up his hand for silence.
"In the mine!" he shouted.
Very faintly it came back.
"Air hole."
"Repeat!" shouted Johnny. It came back.
"Make."
Johnny grabbed a long mine drill. He looked for the thinnest place he could imagine in the white rock wall before him, socked the rock drill point into it, and signaled the man on the drill motor.
"Let her spin."
They bucked the drill into it with the pressure handles. The others would hear it in there and get out of the way. With a high scream, the drill went through. They dragged it out.
"Air hose!" yelled Johnny,
and they fed the hose through the drill hole and turned the air compressor on. Air from the drift squealed back past the sides of the hose and into the rescue crew's faces. 21 minutes later, they had the top of the rockfall cleared and could drag men out. They had to drop the gap farther to get the last one. It was Dunnell Dean, and he had a broken ankle and broken ribs. 17 men, only one with a serious injury. They passed them to the top silently in the hoist buckets. A dust- and sweat-covered Johnny was the last one up. The parson threw a blanket around him. The salvaged crew were bundled up, sitting in the snow, most of them drinking something hot that one of the old women had sent in a huge jug. The parson had finished setting the ankle of Dunnell Dean, and, helped by Robert the Fox, was taping up the ribs. Finally, Thor said, "We lost the load." Nobody said anything. 7. With dawn making a faint, pale line in the east, Johnny looked down into the abyss. The pure white load showed not the slightest trace of gold. It was in plain sight. When the recon drone came over, Turl would have a picture of this. Far, far below, as yet invisible in the darkness, a new fall of rock would tell the story. Johnny tried to guess Turl's reaction. It was difficult to do so, for Turl was undoubtedly over his own edge into madness. How many hours did Johnny have until the drone? Not many. The air was unaccountably still. The morning wind had not started up. The dawn light was reflected back from the surrounding majestic peaks. Johnny ran over to a flying platform and gestured to a pilot to join him. He lifted it up, put it over the edge of the chasm, and dropped it like a rocket to the bottom. He braked it and hovered. Turning on the beam lights of the platform, he examined the mass of fallen rock. Some of it had gone through the river ice. Some of it made a new bank for the stream. He played the light through the debris. It was an enormous mass. Hopefully, he looked for some slightest whiteness that would indicate a piece of the load. None. A ton of gold, perhaps. But now it was buried under a mountain of rockfall, possibly even plunged into the river bottom. The debris was so peaked and broken, one couldn't even land on it. He tossed around the idea of clearing a flat place, but it would take hours and the winds would be here soon. He had to face it. The gold was gone. The morning wind was beginning to blow now. He couldn't stay down here and live to tell about it. If he had another short period of morning quiet, he might do something, but they'd used up their time. He sent the flying platform screaming up to the cliff top. It was already being buffeted by turbulent air. He landed. He told Robert the Fox, "Get these men back to the town." Johnny walked back and forth. The parson looked at him in sympathy.
"We aren't done yet, laddie," said the parson.
The whole group looked to be in the shock of disappointment. Robert the Fox was looking at Johnny. They were loading the saved crew, and two pilots were at the controls of the plane. Dunnell Dean was being eased gently aboard.
"I'm going to do it," said Johnny suddenly.
Robert the Fox and the parson walked over.
"Turl," said Johnny, "doesn't know how close that drift was to the inside of the load. He doesn't know that we hadn't already mined the back of it. If he sees that white quartz out there, he'll know we didn't get to it before the slide. Thor," he shouted, "how close were you to the fissure?"
Thor asked the shift leader, and they did some calculations.
"About 5 feet,"
Thor finally shouted from the plane.
"I'll blow it in," said Johnny. "It doesn't matter now if we blast. I'm going to..."